The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This country is at war with Germany.
We shall go on to the end.
I remember the sheets of flame which came up and almost blinded us from our guns.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. The German offensive to capture Stalingrad began in August 1942, using Frederick Paulus's 6th Army and elements of the 4th Panzer Army. The attack was supported by intense bombing that reduced much of the city to rubble. The battle quickly degenerated into house-to-house fighting as both sides fought for the city on the Volga. By mid-November, the Germans were on the brink of victory as the Soviet defenders clung to a final few slivers of land along the west bank of the river. Then, on the 19th of November, the Red Army launched Operation Uranus, targeting the weaker Romanian allies protecting the 6th Army's flank, and the Germans in Stalingrad were surrounded and cut off. Hitler was determined to hold the city, insisting that Paulus hold out and the 6th Army would be supported by air. With the airlift disaster in February 1943, without food or ammunition, some 91,000 starving Germans surrendered. In this episode of the podcast, I'm joined once more by Jonathan Trigg. John specialises in looking at aspects of the war from the German perspective. So in episode 147, we looked at Operation Barbarossa. In episode 115, John and I discussed the end of the war. And in episode 102, we talked about D-Day. Well, John has a new book out, The Battle of Stalingrad Through German Eyes, The Death of the 6th Army. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Welcome back, John. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Shall we start with Case Blue? I almost think that Stalingrad was an accident. So, Case Blue, I guess that's our starting point. What were its objectives?
You're absolutely right by saying it was an accident. I mean, that encapsulates Stalingrad for me. Barbarossa's failed, died in the snows in front of Moscow in the beginning of December 41. You know, Soviet counteroffensive rolls back, almost destroys the German army in the east. I mean, really does come very, very close to the whole thing just disintegrating. And then, I mean, I think the best way to describe it is Hitler and all of the generals then sat down and go, bugger, what do we do now? There was no plan. There was no, so if we don't win the war with Barbarossa in 41, don't worry, we've got this excellent, you know, secondary plan to do this, this and this. They all just sat there, scratched their heads and go, oh dear, that didn't work. What now? German armed forces were geared to summer war. That's always them. They, you know, until you know, the Ardennes and Battle of the Bulge, and so on, they never mounted a major offensive during winter. They weren't equipped or trained and you know, for it at all. So the Soviets knew that when the spring thaw was over in early 42, the Germans were going to come again, and they thought that they would come against Moscow. So they were prepared, majority of their forces there. They thought, you know, Army Group Center is the fulcrum of the German front in the east. They're going to advance and try and finish the job off. Why wouldn't they attack Moscow? Central government, you know, massive economic power, military power. And most of Germany's generals, most of Hitler's generals thought the same. Thought that makes perfect sense. If we're going to force a decision, and that was all it was going to, we need to force a decision to this war. It was going to be take Moscow. But of course, what they failed to understand was Hitler had perhaps a different view on how to fight a war, on what you're fighting a war for. You know, racial concerns were hugely important for him, but the other one was economic power. He felt that was a subject that he understood, that his generals didn't, because he definitely had an inferiority complex. about his generals in particular, you know, these extremely well-educated, intellectual, staff-trained officers and so on, whereas he'd been a corporal, you know, runner in the First World War and then a Doss House, the kind of resident in Vienna after the war. And so he always felt kind of inferior. But when it came to economics, he thought, I've got one up on my generals. To be fair to him, is he understood that it was Germany's lack of economic resources were always the Achilles heel of Germany throughout the ages, and particularly in a global war, and most of all the biggest lack was oil. You know, Germany has no resource, no oil fields of its own. Within the Reich, they had about a few wells in Austria and a few in Hungary, and large fields around Ploiești in Romania, and they were shipping a lot to Germany. But it was still, in the scale of things, it was tiny. You know, the UK receiving 10 million tons of oil a year from the States and so on, let alone from you know other points of the Middle East and what have you, and there's Nazi Germany getting 1-2 million tons, if it's lucky, from Romania, and trying to run a global war on that sort of basis. And yes, they had synthetic oil plants, they turned brown coal into fuel, which was incredibly expensive. But again, it just, the sheer volume just wasn't there. So Hitler very much thought, right, what we're going to do is we need to secure oil and shed loads of it. And where is that? That's down in the south. That's in the Caucasus. So all around Grozny and Maykop, so in nowadays Chechnya and so on, all, that's where it is. There is this Shangri-La of oil. And if we get it, one, we deprive the Soviets of it, hurrah, and two, we can then literally have a bath in it. And we can, you know, run every tank we want 24/7 and just burn as much fuel, it's absolutely fine. So this is what we're going to do. And then it was about, you know, so once the decision was made, it was about how they were going to plan this enormously complex and difficult operation, because it really did mean, instead of the three prongs of Barbarossa and a front moving all at once, it was, right, other two, Army Group North and Centre, will basically stay in position. We're going to put everything down in Army Group South, and it's going to advance about 1,000 miles, which they'd failed to do in Barbarossa. How they thought that, oh, I know we didn't do it when we were at our strongest, and now we've taken a bit of a kicking over the winter, we can definitely achieve it. They set about, to be honest, just repeating the same mistakes that they had done in 41 with Barbarossa.
So how does Stalingrad become a target?
It wasn't mentioned as a specific objective in Hitler's directive for Case Blue. There was a vague reference to it in terms of what they understood was, by, you know, if you look at a map about what they were trying to do, you're going, that's potty. That doesn't make any sense. We're going to advance on one front, hundreds and hundreds of miles, and just, we're going to be open to attack on our flank, our left-hand northern flank, for hundreds upon hundreds of miles. And they said the way that we're going to stop that happening, they described it as we're going to build a hard shoulder so that the mass of the German force would head down to the Caucasus and get the oil. And a secondary force, but still very large, would then literally go straight east and hit the Volga River. And of course, any look at the map says you're going to arrive somewhere in the Stalingrad area. And it would make sense to take Stalingrad and use that as your kind of anchor point, and then stretch your soldiers across the kind of the river line to form this hard shoulder that then protects all the troops going down to Caucasus and getting the oil. But of course, what that meant is that you've got two wildly diverting objectives. Yet again, the Achilles heel of the German armed forces is its inability to solve its logistics issues comes massively into play. It must have been a bit surreal, because they're going, right, so what we'll do is this kind of secondary objective going towards the Volga. Literally, what we're going to do, we'll have the Sixth Army, which is the largest field force in the Wehrmacht at the time. And just march in that direction. That's literally what we want you to do. Just keep on going, you know, across the steppe for hundreds and hundreds of miles until you'll probably hit the Volga around there, kind of Stalingrad-y way. When you do, stop and, you know, dig in, and then everything will be absolutely fine. And so they must have just gone, this is a bit weird. And they just kind of literally just marched off. It's like the Ninth Legion. You know, when they disappeared in the Highlands, it's like going, these guys just must have just gone marching, going, where the hell are we going? Just literally, just in this heat haze, and dying of thirst, and they're going, we've got to march 30 miles a day again, which is kind of what we did last year, and we're going to have to keep on doing it, and we're just going to keep on until when? And of course, they constantly kept on running out of fuel. So they had to stop, wait a couple of weeks until they got, you know, fuel brought up, then go again, then stop. And it was stop, start, stop, start. They're fighting, you know, quite a few battles kind of along the way, losing a lot of guys, actually, you know, several thousand men had gone before they got anywhere near. And then eventually they start to arrive before Stalingrad, one of the weirdest designed cities in Europe. And obviously European Russia at the time, because of course most cities, if you kind of look at them from an aerial perspective, they're kind of oval, roundy, overly type shapes. That's just the way that they work. And particularly those with rivers running through them. You know, it tends to be, you'll either have a northern and a southern, or an east or a west or whatever. Yeah. So that's the way it's formed. Stalingrad, no, absolutely not. What we'll do is we'll have the eastern bank with literally hardly anything on it. So on the far bank, as the Germans would see it, we'll have a few suburbs, but nothing much at all. Everything's going to be on the western bank. And what we're going to do is just, we're not going to build out into the steppe. We're just going to build along the river for miles and miles and miles. So it's like a strip mall that just runs for you know, 20 odd miles from north to south, but is about 4 miles wide. And it's at its broadest. So it really is. It's a stick, and you know, the Germans are getting closer and closer. But again, every time they get close, run out of fuel, stop again. And in the meantime, the drive towards the Caucasus is carrying on, and that's where everyone is focusing. So all Hitler's generals are focusing on the drive. That's you know, the primary objective. That's where you want to go. Friedrich Paulus and the Sixth Army, they'll reach the river, and then they'll do what we always do: take the city. The Russians will, you know, fight a bit, and then they'll evacuate to the eastern bank and disappear. And hey ho, it's all going to plan.
Who was Paulus? You mentioned him there. He's got, you know, such a powerful unit. He had been in North Africa at one point. He pops up overseas.
Yeah, he was a strange character, Merritt. He was very highly thought of by a majority of the kind of very, very top senior German leadership, including Hitler, who thought this guy was a real, you know, he was a winner and he knew what he was doing and so on. But he hadn't held a command appointment bigger than battalion. That had been his last big one. And since then, it's just been staff jobs. And he was, you know, a real product of the German general staff system. So he understood staff work and how it operated, but just, to be honest, was a bit lost when it came to commanding troops in the field. He had lots and lots of little idiosyncrasies. So he was called, you know, the Lord and so on, because he didn't like dirt. He was obsessive about getting dirt under his fingernails. That really freaked him out. So he used to wear gloves a lot. He'd insist on having a kind of a bath every day, even on campaign in the field, and would change his shirts in particular regularly, you know, 2-3 times a day. I felt that was very important. And he wasn't, you know, a Rommel and so on, you know, leading from the front out with the troops. He was a MAPS general. Yeah, that's what he was. And that's how he ran his campaigns. And to put someone, you know, like that in charge of the largest field force in the army, I don't think, well, it wasn't a good decision, because he just simply didn't have the experience to do it. And then, you know, the Sixth Army had been remodeled kind of over the winter. It had a host of new divisions brought into it. You know, it was this kind of new breed of army that the Germans were trying to do. So before, they'd had infantry armies and panzer armies. And Sixth Army was a bit of a hybrid, as with a lot of hybrids. It was a really rubbish decision, because that you just, what you, instead of solving the problems that the infantry or the armour had. So armour needed more infantry, infantry needed more mobility. Actually, what you did was you made both issues worse. You had panzers that would just race ahead of their infantry, get themselves in a bit of trouble, and then have to stop and wait for the infantry again. And then they'd run out of fuel, so the infantry couldn't move because they couldn't leave the panzers stranded. So it was a poorly thought out experiment, really, in military structure. And they put a guy in charge of it who was not suited to field command. You know, this guy would have made an absolutely great chief of staff, not a problem at all. But put him in charge of a field army that has to do what Sixth Army was tasked with doing. You're asking for trouble, really.
Did he expect to have to take Stalingrad? I mean, what was his plan? Or did he just think that they could bypass it somehow, or, I mean, as they're done elsewhere?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I, obviously, doing the research, I never understood why he insisted on attacking the place. Because, you know, why bother?
I can't help but feel, because he's got the word Stalin in the title, everybody became obsessed with it, possibly more than they needed to.
Yeah, it did over time, I think, because there's always been this issue. Oh, it's like, oh, the Germans got drawn into a street battle and they got no experience of street warfare. And I'm like going, really? How many cities have they already taken? They've taken dozens. They knew what they were doing in that respect. And what they usually did, they bypassed them. So they're going to be defended. They literally just go, you know, north and south of it, bounce over the river, turn around, surround the place. And the Soviets would go, let's head off. And then the Germans would do what the Germans did, which is level it. So, you know, aerial bombardment, boom, 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 shock and awe, hit them with loads and loads of firepower. And then they just go, right, do you know what? This is rubbish. Let's go. Bang. And they all skedaddle. And that had been the way that they'd taken city after city after city that the Soviets had defended. The ones that they didn't defend, they'd obviously just take fairly easily. But that's the way they did it. But when Paulus and the Sixth Army got near to Stalingrad, I think logistics was the key issue. He just didn't have the fuel to do what was sensible, which was to cut the place off. You know, big sweeping maneuvers. They were, you know, that logistics issue forced them into doing something that they weren't prepared to do. And then Paulus's plan was, right, we'll reach the northern and southern ends of the city and then just attack kind of up and down the river and meet in the middle. And we'll just roll them up. And it was a poorly thought through plan that they then insisted on continuing with for the best part of August and September 1942. And it just turned into a meat grinder, an absolute meat grinder. And the Soviets at first weren't that bothered themselves about defending it.
Well, is there anything strategic about Stalingrad particularly?
It was more about the Volga River itself, because the issue for them was that the Volga was the artery through which all of their grain from the south would, you know, everything would flow from the south, all the resources would then flow up to, you know, to Moscow and so on, into the Russian heartland. And of course, there's big tank factories there and all that type of thing. But to be honest, they've got industry beyond the Urals. So they didn't need it in that way. Just as the Germans hadn't designated it as a primary objective. You know, it's that old phrase, facts on the ground. You know, the Soviets hadn't designated it as a primary defensive position either. And then as the battle kind of progressed and ramped up, I mean, it was like a high stakes poker game that they start to ramp up against each other. So all of a sudden you've got Stalin saying, hang on a sec, there's something happening here. Right, we'll start, you know, blaring out huge announcements of the heroic defenders of Stalingrad. There is no land beyond the Volga. Defend it, last man, last bullet, all that type of stuff. And of course, Hitler and the Nazi propaganda machine hear that, perk up, and then all of a sudden it's like going, oh yes, Stalin's city. Yeah, he's all getting uppity about it. So we need to take it. So then he's constantly, you know, badgering Paulus, going, when are you gonna take the city? We need to take it. So he goes to give his annual speech to party faithful at the Bürgerbräu Keller. And he's like going, oh, there's this city on the Volga. Oh, I think it's called Stalingrad. Oh, who cares? We're going to take it. It's all fantastic. And so they just kept on from this place that no one really bothered that much about at the beginning. took on, you know, it took on a life of its own. You know, the Soviets realized the Germans were just, you know, battering. That's all they were doing. There's no innovation, you know, no real, you know, plan or whatever. It was just thump, 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 which the Germans were not structured, equipped or trained to do. And the Soviets realized, well, they could just drip feed in enough blood to keep a foothold in the city and keep the Germans, you know, wearing themselves against it. And then if they did lose it, well, they lost it, but they could talk about heroic defense. Everything's great. It wouldn't really matter. And it went on like that for you know, into October. And again, you know, the Germans were just, it literally measured in yards. And it's like going, oh, yes, only been 14 days and we've already taken that building. Suddenly you get these, you know, the names of the Red October factory and, you know, and so on, and the Lazo Chemical Works and so on. The Barricardi factory, all these things that they take on a life of their own. You know, the grain elevator in the south, and you know, the Mamayev Kurgan in the centre of the city, and all of a sudden it's they are huge bodies of troops are expending massive amounts of ammunition on the German side to literally take a building that's 200 metres by 500 metres or whatever, losing huge amounts of casualties. And of course, for them, that's a real issue. The Soviets, I mean, you know, the Soviets have never really given an accurate, or they never did, obviously, but an accurate picture of their casualties. But literally, the plan was that they were going to, you know, pour blood and meat into the German tank tracks to stop them. I mean, it was to use flesh to clog up the German war machine, and it's horrific. But it's also brilliant, and it really does. It just wears them down. The Germans drive, and they just haven't got the reinforcements because, of course, at the same time, their main body of the offensive is down in the Caucasus. You know, all of a sudden, they're leaving Europe. They're in Asia. Now they've got Bactrian camels, you know, humping forward ammunition, and they're looking at the Caucasus Mountains and Mount Elbrus and all this type of thing, and they go, oh my God, this is weird. You know, that was the objective of Blue. And yet over time, you know, over those kind of, you know, late August, September, October, the emphasis shifts for both the Soviets and the Germans to Stalingrad, to a place that no one looked at before. And the real objective of the operation, which was to get that oil, suddenly becomes almost irrelevant. I mean, in a way, it suited Hitler, because he hadn't, just as with Barbarossa, Army Group South was not resourced to do what he wanted it to do. It just simply didn't have the mass, and they were just running out of troops. So, you know, what the start of the offensive would be, you know, three armies going forward into the Caucasus, suddenly it's the best part of two, and then it gets down to one, and then it's three corps, then it's a corps, then it's a, you know, a couple of divisions. And by the end, they're launching attacks with battalions, and they're still hundreds of miles from where they wanted to be. And he looks at you going, how did they think, even if they reach these oil fields, and they did reach one in Maykop, but how do they think they're going to exploit it? Because you don't just turn up and go, oh, there you go, SO petrol station, that's handy. Just keep on pouring it, boys. We're perfectly fine. You've got, you know, huge infrastructure of oil drilling and refining, and then you've got to transport it and all this type of thing. And they're literally looking around going, oh, well, there's eight of us. How's that going to work? And it was. It's just they ran out of steam, ran out of machines, ran out of men, and ran out of ideas, really.
What's the Luftwaffe doing over Stalingrad? Because presumably they could be interdicting the Russians as they're coming in. Did the Luftwaffe still have air superiority at this point?
They did. But the issue with the Luftwaffe always was that they could finance one major point of effort, and they were being asked to do about 14 at the same time, and they simply didn't have the mass. So the Luftwaffe is there over Stalingrad. You know, they carried out a huge initial raid in August, and they were, you know, trying to do the best they could, but they were still then being told your main effort has got to be down in the Caucasus. So you're on, you know, forward grass airstrips in the middle of the steppe, hundreds of miles away from absolutely everyone, and you've still got to be, you know, defeating the Soviets over that. And oh, by the way, we need to also keep them away from Army Group Centre and Army Group North, and oh, and the Mediterranean Theatre is suddenly geeing up now, because of course at that time we're talking getting towards El Alamein, so Rommel is screaming for more air packers. Our Desert Air Force is absolutely giving him a bit of a kicking. Luftwaffe is being told you've got to send more resources down to the Mediterranean, down to Africa, and they're going, geez, where's it going to come from? You can just see it in the figures. So the bombing raids and what they're able to do, it just goes down and down and down, and quite rapidly. So the Soviets, who are pretty much being left alone on the eastern bank, they can mass artillery, shoot across the river at the Germans and be relatively safe, and at the same time just keep on feeding men and supplies into the city. And yes, they'll Stukas will blow a few of the boats up and all that type of thing. Oh, well, never mind. I mean, we're talking about a Red Army war machine that would, form a new division in a fortnight, 5,000-6,000 men up to 10,000 men. They'd be formed in that time, and they'd literally be semi-equipped. So they say, right, half the guys can have a weapon. Most of the rifles won't have stocks, for instance, because, it takes time to put a stock on a rifle. You don't need it. Don't be silly. It's perfectly fine. We'll give you a handful of rounds and no maps, just march that way and just appear. And then it wasn't a case of, okay, you've fought really hard for the last kind of week, so you've pulled out the line for rest. It's literally, you stay in the line until you've either won or you're dead. And when the unit, is burnt out completely and it's disintegrated, they just form another one, feed that in.
Is this time that not only didn't write it down, but the Soviets start introducing that SMG, don't they?
The PPSH 41,
the classic looking thing with a drum magazine.
I mean, fantastic.
Are they there in number? I mean, is that a revolutionary thing? Because presumably you could just give those out to troops with not a lot of training and just send them forward and just say fire, just spray.
Just spray. And you're absolutely right. That's what they did in the course. In their kind of environment, street fighting, usually fighting very close. So, you're out on the steppe. You want an accurate rifle that can shoot out to 300 metres. So your German soldier with his Mauser 98 is going, this is a bit of a winner. Bolt action, bang. Oh, there's another one. Yeah, bang. It's like potting rabbits. But, of course, all of a sudden he's in a city where the Soviets are 20 metres away, if not closer. And his bolt action rifle now that can accurately hit something at 300 metres is actually a bit of an impediment, because the guys he's fighting have got a submachine gun, with a drum magazine, and they're just spraying him. Now, his squad leader has the old classic Schmeisel, although of course they weren't Schmeisels, MP40s. So he has one of those, but he's the only one that has it. So everyone else has got a rifle, and they're up against a Soviet squad, same number, where one of them might have a rifle, the rest have got some machine guns. The Soviets really did improvise and innovate where the Germans didn't. So yes, they just did not care about casualties. And they had their infamous blocking detachments. So, made up of squads of officers and soldiers who were particularly, loyal to the party and what have you, who would form up behind an attack. Soviets would go charging forward. And if they failed and then tried to retreat, they'd get shot by their own side. Zhukov famously said it takes a very brave man to be a coward in the Red Army. I think he got it spot on. But at the same time, they did improvise. So, they set up street fighting academies in the city, and they trained their squads actually in the city, almost under German fire. They absolutely adapted what they were going to do for the environment they were in. So they said, right, we'll have, we'll have an assault detachment, and they will take building X. So, that building, that they'll take it, but they're going to be followed up by another detachment that as soon as they've got that building, they're in, and then they're equipped differently, because they set up for defense, because they know German military dogma is counterattack. So always counterattack. So they know Germans thrown out of the building, they're going to counterattack. So new fresh guys come in who then set up mines. They've got wire, they've got more machine guns, and etc. So when the Germans counterattack, the Russians are waiting for them, and the Germans go, oh my god, I can't believe this. We thought the best time to throw someone out of a building is when you've just lost it, and they're just sitting there because they're sweating and they're absolutely knackered and they've taken all the casualties. Well, also they've got fresh troops, and they also have flanking detachments who will then come out and cut off the Germans who are trying to counter it. I mean, they really did. And then the use of snipers. snipers, for instance, you know, in a modern British army, you would have, you know, for instance, you might have a sniper detachment in a battalion, maybe a platoon. The Soviets were like going, we don't want a few hundred, we want thousands. Thousands of them. We don't need to train them to hit a target at 5 kilometres and so on a windy day. We just need them to have some basic sniper training. We'll use specially tooled normal rifles. So during the process of, you know, the Mosin Nagant rifles, they'd literally say, oh, right, okay, this one, it's going on the production line. We'll just engineer it to be, you know, higher standard. But not go over the top, and then fit it with a scope, and there you go, sniper rifle. And they're handed out in their tens of thousands. So the Soviets don't have 20, 50, 100 snipers. They've got hundreds. And they start to, again, innovate with them. So Vasily Zaitsev's, you know, idea of the sixes. So we have three teams of two. So three shooters, three spotters. They'll be in points and completely dominate an area. None of that area is not covered by a sniper team. So anything that's in it is gone. And we'll use them in an innovative way. So we'll go, for instance, what we know is all our food, you know, on the Soviet side, now the Americans are pouring lend-lease, stuff in. They get dried rations and all that type of thing, and that's what they're eating, all packaged. So, but of course, the Germans don't have that. No, absolutely not. Germans, like the French, you know, they have wonderful field kitchens that produce a beautiful meal of bratwurst and vegetables and so on. It's all hot and lovely, and it's all produced in the rear. And then companies will send a couple of guys back with a container on the back, all filled up, and then they'll come back with their one hot meal a day that all the guys been so looking forward to, can't wait, until, hey presto, the snipers start drilling them. Even if they don't kill them, they've dived to the floor, half this hot food is shot up over their neck and on the ground, and then they're under fire, so by the time they get there, it's freezing cold, there's hardly any of it left. You know, if they're trying to get to water points, we'll set up snipers by water points, so, you know, they can't even get fresh water in there. In the heat. And all what we'll do is the Germans, again, don't use radios. They use landlines. So we'll cut the landline and then just wait. And at some point, Fritz will turn up, following down the line to find where the brake is to bend it, bang, shoot him and wait for his mate to turn up. Because then they go, oh, it's not working. What's happened to Fritz? Go, Hans, you go out and see where Fritz is. You know, well, Fritz is now dead. And Hans follows him very quickly. And all of this starts to kind of come together and wears away that the very innards of the Sixth Army. You know, this army that hadn't gone through Barbarossa as a formed unit in the state that it was. You know, most, as I said, lots and lots of the divisions were new. So all the veteran divisions have been, well, a lot of the veteran divisions have been transferred out. They got a lot of new divisions in, and they hadn't operated as an army, for very long at all before this. And so they're just getting used to the, you know, each other and how it all worked. And they're just being worn away. As soon as they get any ammunition, it's fired. I mean, the ammunition expenditure is just beyond belief. It is very much, we'll blast everything. We'll blast. And then, you know, they start, for instance, they start going, right, what we'll do is we'll have the panzers lead. So they'll charge down the streets and the infantry will follow, so the infantry will be protected. But of course, a panzer can't go down a street in Stalingrad because it's an absolute mess. There's huge craters and there's massive piles of rubble and, you know, the tracks are being lost. So you know, they're being channeled into where the Soviets want them. Mines, anti-tank guns, you know, throwing Molotov cocktails down on them from above and all that. So, of course, then they go, oh, that didn't work. So what we'll do is we'll send the infantry forward first and hold the tanks back, and the tanks will then provide fire support. Of course, the infantry are going forward going, mate, this idea. You know, get Panzer Boy to lead on this. He's got covered in steel. I'm wearing a 1942 blooming field blouse. You know, that's not going to repel a flamethrower. They start to then take casualties and just go to ground. And their officers and NCOs are trying to get them up, and they're going, oh, I don't think so. Get the tanks forward, and we'll think about it. But so you know, they try things, and then they have this view. They bring in their, well, they call them pioneer battalions. It was pioneers for British military in the war, basically with someone with a shovel. And I don't mean to denigrate pioneers, of course, but it was a shovel and they used to dig holes. Pioneers in the German army were assault engineers, combat engineers, and they are specially trained, and they're highly motivated. and they're specialist troops, and they've got, you know, a range of equipment that suits them for street fighting. But it's the sheer numbers. So for every battalion of combat pioneers that the Germans are putting forward, that the Soviets are putting in a division. No matter how good these guys are, they're just getting overwhelmed with just sheer numbers. And Paulus's answer constantly is just more firepower, more of the same. I've got no other ideas. We're just going to grind. He was literally ripping the heart out of his own army in this mistaken belief that you'd hit this nirvana of you suddenly take all the city and, hey presto, what, the war would end? You know, the Soviets would just give up and so on. You know, just not going to happen.
Were they prepared for another winter? Winter's closing in.
Remarkably, they were. Again, when I read about Stalingrad a lot before, I did think, oh, there's pictures of them, you know, they've got no winter uniforms again, you know, and all this type of stuff. You go, oh, the bloody hell, you know, they're all wearing ladies' scarves around their necks and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But no, so they had actually prepared for another winter because they knew they were going to, unlike Barbarossa, where they thought, no, we're not going to, because it's going to be over before winter, so we're not going to have to do it. They thought, no, it's not going to be over, so we need to be prepared. So they'd you know, ordered thousands of winter uniforms, reversible, you know, winter uniforms, and they were all stored behind the lines. They built massive numbers of dugouts because, of course, the army wasn't just in the city itself. It was out on a steppe going out towards the River Don. They built huge numbers of shelters that were purpose-built, you know, covered from artillery fire and stoves in and, you know, actually pretty comfortable. They got, you know, special greases in for weaponry and so on. But, of course, that was all in their bases, secure logistics bases, actually quite a hell of a way from Stalingrad, because no one ever thought that the Soviets would counterattack. The Slavic Untermenschen, they can't possibly, you know, we do things like that and not them. So we'll leave it in all of our main bases until it's needed in the winter. And so in the meantime, it's not needed because it's still quite warm, you know, even October. Along comes someone with a different idea, which is obviously Georgi Zhukov.
Was that's Uranus, Operation Uranus?
Yes. And Stalin's idea was, oh, lovely counterattack, like that idea. But it was fairly limited, caused more attrition and surprise them. Didn't really think in kind of large terms, whereas Zhukov thought, and it came from his understanding that the Germans had put themselves in a really tricky position, in that the Case Blue itself was predicated on the fact is they just didn't have enough Germans. They lost so many in Barbarossa, in particular during the winter, that they just didn't have the numbers. So what they relied on was, you know, they did a tour of the Allied capitals, and they said, no, you know, you gave us about a division before. Well, what we really need is a lot more. And the Allies had responded. So the Italians gave the 8th Army, which is one of their largest field formations. The Hungarians, their 2nd Army. And the Romanians, even more so. Romanians, too. It was the 3rd and 4th.
I hadn't realised there was quite so many non-Germans in the up there.
I mean, Rundstedt, who commanded Army Group South to start with, he described it as a League of Nations army. He was quite dismissively. I mean, this was always one of the major problems with the Nazis was they didn't play well with other children. You know, the Allied Grand Alliance is a lesson in how to have coalition warfare, whereas the Nazis, you know, were the other end of the spectrum. They relied on so much of that hard shoulder, you know, to be protected by Allied forces. So the German 6th Army is fighting in Stalingrad. To its south is the Romanian 4th Army. To its kind of northwest, is the 3rd Romanian Army. Then you've got the Italians, then you've got the Hungarians. Yeah, they're stretching away. They've got ridiculously long frontages that they simply don't have the men or weapons to cover. And they're not equipped for it. I mean, they've barely got a modern anti-tank gun between them. In the main, they are not well trained. You know, their equipment, if what equipment they've got is a heck of a lot, is obsolete. You know, they've got barely any armor. You know, they're just sitting there. And the belief was, well, as long as they're there, they're doing something useful. We'd have to worry about it. We've got a Panzer Corps behind them, which, so if the Soviets do attack, then we got a Panzer Corps which will push them back. But of course, you know, the Panzer Corps that they were relying on just, it didn't have the power. I mean, I had one German tank division, which was a fairly new one, the 22nd, that performed fairly poorly up until that point. And then the Romanian 1st Panzer Division with a load of old Czech and French tanks. So, I mean, and that was, it's nothing like a, you know, proper frontline German Panzer Corps.
So when Uranus hits, do they just fold? I mean, the narrative always is, oh, they just fold. They were, you know, they were not German troops. They were not interested in
them. And that is, and I, to be honest, I always thought that was the case. I thought, you know, pictures I had in my mind was, you know, loads of T-34s and white-clad Soviet infantry charging through the snow, and Romanians, Italians and Hungarians, oh, throwing up their hands as soon as they saw their first Russian and, you know, running away. And that just is not true. Yes, some of them folded pretty quickly, but very large numbers, and particularly Romanians, fought very, very hard. The battle was kind of in the, you know, in the balance for quite some time, and there was just no reaction. There was disbelief on the German side that the Soviets could actually be doing something significant. It's thought, you know, that they're not capable of mounting a large, despite what they suffered back in December. So you know, they just literally powerless, just sat on his hands and said, oh no, nothing to do with us, nothing to see here, you know, let's carry on taking a block of shops in Stalingrad. Whilst at the same time, his northern flank is being immolated. The Soviets just pour more force in. The Romanians are immobile and hardly got any vehicles. Once the Soviets are through, then they're dead. There's nothing they can do. And they literally just disintegrate. But after putting up a stiff fight, and they did so in this, not as much in the south, because the 4th Army had been wrecked in the Battle for Odessa back in 41, taken huge casualties, and was a shadow of its former self. But even they really did put up a fight. But once the Soviets were through them, they couldn't react. You know, they couldn't redeploy to get in front of the Soviets again. They were literally cut off and wandering across the snow-covered steppes, going, what the hell do we do now? And the Germans just didn't react quickly enough. And all of a sudden, the Panzer Corps, Ferdinand Heim's Panzer Corps, gets, right, you've got a counterattack here. You're our last chance. And, of course, everything happens. So he's got the Romanian Panzer Division, they've done fairly well, but of course they'd suffered very badly. Their equipment was very obsolete. They weren't anything like a German Panzer Division in terms of strength. There was very little coordination. Their communications broke down between the two divisions pretty much straight away. And as for the Germans, they have so little fuel that what they'd done before the weather is that they dug the panzers into, you know, earth kind of dugouts and then surrounded them with straw to protect them. And of course, that was all lovely and cozy. And it was lovely and cozy for mice. When I read about this, I was like going, that's just crazy. That is crazy. But yeah, the mice were just in there. And of course, because they were so short on fuel, what would normally happen is that every day the Panzer crew would get in their Panzer and they take it out and they run the engine and, you know, and then they do maintenance and so on. But they couldn't do that because they didn't have the fuel. So they just left them for weeks. And of course, the mice had just overrun these things and chewed through the electric cables. So they press the starter buttons and nothing happens. Literally about half the Panzers, they can't even start. And then all of the roads are covered in ice and snow, so that they have proper kind of snow tracks for them. Great. Where are they? And they can't find them. They were lost somewhere back in the midst of time. You know, the Panzers are then sliding off the tracks into ditches and, oh my, it's an utter disaster. So by the time they get into the fight, there's literally a tiny amount of them. And the most they can do is give the Soviets a bit of a knock and then retreat themselves. So this amazing counterattack of a strong German Panzer Corps just disappeared. By the time it hit, it was you know, had the power of a ball of steam.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with you in a moment.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back. I'm talking to Jonathan Trigg and we're discussing Stalingrad. There's 100,000 men encircled in Stalingrad, isn't there? Was the discussions on whether you take 100,000 men and punch out, which presumably that's got quite a punch to punch out, or did they just think, well, there must be something out there, let's relieve them?
The Soviets at first, when their pincers came together at Kalach on the Don, you know, they'd never mounted an operation like that before, and it succeeded. They were actually quite taken aback, and Zhukov was kind of telling Stalin, and he was hedging his bets because he didn't want to disappoint the boss. He said, "I think we might have encircled 80,000 Germans." And of course, Stalin was going, 80,000, that's amazing, that's incredible. And then actually, it was over 200,000. And there was, you know, the whole 6th Army, bar a few troops that managed to escape, a lot of the 4th Panzer Army, loads of Croats, there were Slovaks, there were Romanians who hadn't managed to escape. My picture before of the way that they decided with the airlift was all the Germans, you know, senior officers said, right, we need to punch out. We need to break out as when the encircle is at its weakest. So straight away, get out now, and then, you know, redeploy, sort ourselves out and come back stronger. And then Hitler had made a one of his immensely stupid decisions and said, no, we're going to stay where you are, we're going to resupply by air. But the picture is far more nuanced than that. So German senior commanders were split. So a lot of the generals inside Stalingrad said, we've got to go. That means we're going to leave a lot of our heavy equipment. We might even leave some of the wounded, but we have got to get out now. It's our kind of only chance. But Paulus wasn't giving a lead. So it's his army. And he was literally kind of turning around to the generals going, well, what do you think? And they're like, well, what do you think? Because, you know, you are our commander. And he said, well, you know, I'll take a consensus view, which is not what an army commander should be doing. Back in German headquarters, Hitler was undecided himself. He wanted to know, is it possible for the airlift to happen? You know, Goering famously, you know, yes, Mein Führer, you know, of course we can definitely put an airlift and keep it together. And of course, you know, load of other generals, chief of staff, Zeitzler, was going, you're mad. There's no way we can do that. He's like, do you even know how much stuff they're going to need? And Goering goes, no. And Hitler says, well, if, you know, Goering's my deputy, and if he says he can do it, then it's out of my hands. I can't say he's a liar. And then they try to work out. Well, they didn't even try to work out. Then literally they were just guessing as to how much stuff, what tonnage was needed per day. I mean, no one at any time, as far as I can, you know, ascertain, sat down and worked out what 6th Army needed to survive. So this figure, this magical figure of 300 tons a day.
Doesn't sound like a lot to me.
No, exactly. And it really was. It was just guesswork. They're kind of going, yeah, that probably sounds about right.
Fuel and ammunition's heavy.
that's it. And again, you know, I mean, the airlift was an unmitigated disaster from start to finish. It really was. That's the thing. Fuel and ammo are bulky, heavy items. And an army uses an absolute pile of it all the time. So let alone food. Food was not important at that stage because the army has quite a lot of resources. Needed fuel and ammunition more than anything else. The Luftwaffe's transport arm, after the losses at Crete in particular back in 1941, was just nowhere capable of mounting the sort of massive, coordinated, effective airlift that was going to be needed to support that. And I think they hit the 300 ton a day figure about a dozen times in total during the entire siege, because it was winter. They didn't factor in the weather. So loads of days were snowed out. transport aircraft they had. I mean, literally, it could take a few tons, if that. And it took ages to load and unload them. Soviet fighters were everywhere. By then, the Luftwaffe was having real problems protecting its own transport aircraft and providing any sort of air cover. There was no organization. And what always amazed me was that Paulus and his chief of staff, Schmidt, never, ever once went to see what was going on with the airlift. The lifeline for their army, they never once bothered to go and see it for themselves, because they were going, well, that's a Luftwaffe responsibility. And of course, the Soviets just feasted, kept on pushing west. And it just meant that the airlift, airfield after airfield kept on getting taken. So the airlift kept on getting further and further away. It was an absolute spiral of disaster. So many of the personal stories that you read is from guys who did get out.
What amazed me is they were taken in and out field posts, or certainly taken out field posts as well. Why wouldn't you? But it was like, wow, of all the things you're filling up with tons and tons of letters.
It was how they decided who would get out as well. I decided what they'd bring in. There was no real organisation for a very, very long time. Not the kind of the depth of organisation that you'd require. The guys himself, like Fritz Moritz, was the kind of chief Luftwaffe guy, Fritz Morzink, who was doing it. Now, he was very good, but he just didn't have a big staff. And on the Stalingrad side, it was literally just a few officers, and small staffs at the airports, at Gumrak and so on, literally dealing with this flow that was life and death for them all. It just didn't seem to be a real priority. And at the same time, they're fighting. And it gets to the point where that issue about ammunition, so hardly any fuel coming in. And so it means all of a sudden they can't manoeuvre. So they've still got the best part of 200 Panzers in the pocket, but the things can't move. They can't move their artillery because they can't move the prime movers don't have fuel. And artillery, when it can fire, you've got to ask God, because you're allowed to fire one round. And it gets to the point where, even the soldiers were told, unless you're directly under attack, don't shoot, because we don't have the bullets. So the Red Army guys are wandering around their trenches, all standing up, perfectly fine, because they know the Germans can't fire them, because they haven't got the bullets. This whole thing about food was the killer for the Sixth Army needs reviewing on it, because it did become a huge issue. Obviously, once they'd eaten every horse they could get their hands on, and they had tens of thousands of the things by that stage. By the time they started to starve, they were gone anyway, because they couldn't fire, they didn't have the ammunition, they couldn't move because they didn't have the fuel. So really, the food was a bit of a was not the killer, because by then, as an army, they'd shot their bolt.
By that point, I presume they just can't. There's no way they could even break out anyway. They're not going anywhere.
Manstein launched his counteroffensive, Winter Storm Wintergewitter, to try and break in. But again, he had no fresh troops, so he was doing it with the few men that he had. He needed Paulus to break out. He wasn't strong enough to get to the city. And of course, Paulus just did exactly what he did before, which was sat on his hands. An abrogation of responsibility, and that's what I find in an army that absolutely prided itself. Its entire dogma was individual soldiers at all levels make decisions. That's what they are trained to do. It's absolutely part of our military way of life. Making a decision, whatever it is better than making no decision. That was the entire basis for German command structure. And yet here you have an army commander who is just avoiding that exact thing, not making any decision. He's not touring around his troops. He's not going and seeing what's like in the front line. He literally sits in his headquarters. I mean, throughout the battle, he'd stayed far out in the steppe, and it was only, he was told when they were first encircled, you've got to get close to the city, because he was like 30 miles away. He stayed in his dugout throughout the entire time, and did not go out and see what was going on through his own eyes. He just kind of let it happen. He was completely passive. If you look at the whole German senior command structure for Army Group South, all of them were, to be honest. Vikes is been brought in as because they created two army groups. Vikes, the army group commander, he doesn't even figure. Very highly rated, successful commander. But he's like, what are you doing? What do you? How do you fill your days? because you're not making any you know important decisions about what's happening in this battle that could be a turning point in the war in the East. It seems to just disappear between Hitler and Paulus. It becomes this thing between the two of them, where Paulus literally will not make any decision without Hitler's explicit say-so.
It makes you wonder how he thought he was going to win. I mean, did the men in the field think they were just going to fight to the last man? Did they think, I mean, the men in the field had no idea what was happening other than we haven't got any food and ammunition, but presumably the Russians offered surrender at some point. You know,
They did. I mean, what they'd, you know, guys had desert or they'd capture them and then they'd get them to, you know, all of a sudden they'd be, you know, on a megaphone going, oh, you know, it's Hans here and I came over to our Soviet friends and, oh, they're so lovely. I've eaten more than I can possibly say. And why don't you all just lay down your weapons? It's you know, you're just ordinary German soldiers, just like me. And the Soviets, they're just like us. You know, shoot the Nazi officers and come over. And so none of them believed that. They all believed, almost to a one, that Hitler wasn't going to leave them in the lurch. You read their letters, which as you rightly said, they used to take out. In the aircraft on the airlift, and is that they just go, oh yeah, I know Führer's not going to leave us in the lurch. He is going to come and get us. The commanders at army level, in particular in the division, knew that wasn't true. After Manstein's counteroffensive failed, they knew they were on their own. But the soldiers just didn't. The soldiers thought, no, Hitler will not leave us here to starve and die. He'll come out with something. He'll pull something out of the bag. And of course, unbeknown to them, by then, Hitler is kind of just saying to his generals, right, you mustn't surrender, because every day that you tie down huge Soviet forces gives us a breathing space. He'd written them off, but they didn't know that. They absolutely believed in him.
Amazing loyalty, isn't it?
Yeah, a blind loyalty, absolutely blind loyalty in this, you know, in this figure, and in their own command structure. It's like they couldn't fathom that the German army was going to fail against Slavic Untermensch. Intellectually, they couldn't process that thought. It just, you know, it just couldn't happen. You know, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's kind of heartbreaking because when you read their Feldpost letters, you know that it's an illusion. Yeah, and they're either going to die in the fighting, or they're going to go into a gulag, which probably have no chance of coming out. You know, but they're almost pathetic in their kind of belief in it'll be all right.
Is there a mass surrender? Or does it all kind of just fizzle out and there's sort of a surrender because Paulus is surrendered, but what is he surrendering?
So even till the end, so right at the end, he put his headquarters in the Univermag kind of department store in the cellars there. And he'd been invisible for days. And he was out of contact with most of his senior commanders. The city itself had then been broken into two parts. So there was a northern pocket and Paulus was in the southern pocket. As the commander, it was his kind of responsibility. I mean, he'd asked Hitler repeatedly for permission to surrender. Hitler refused. And then Hitler tried the old tactic of promoting him to field marshal. No German field marshal had ever surrendered. If worse comes to worse, they committed suicide. Paulus knew exactly what Hitler was kind of offering him. And he was like going, oh, I'm a Catholic and suicide is a sin. So I'm not going to do that. Oh, no, absolutely not. But what he also refused to do was to surrender his army. And yet again, gave them no leadership. And then the Soviets turn up at his place and they say, oh, we'll get a car to take you to our headquarters. And, you know, him and Schmidt get in there and get taken over. And they kind of surrender themselves, but Paulus just refuses to surrender the army and said it's down to them. So the northern pocket actually carries on for a day or so until they're just, you know, they're ground to bits. And then it really did. It was, you know, you use exactly right. It was a real anticlimax. It fizzled out. Survivors would say, all of a sudden, kind of looked out from our, you know, shelter, and there's just Soviet soldiers just wandering around, and they're not firing anymore. And because we just kind of said, that's it, it's all done. Yeah, all of a sudden, there's no artillery coming down on us. We're not getting fired at, so they just kind of walk out of their shelters, hands up, and start to shuffle. And thousands of wounded are left in the snow, and you know, they all die. They freeze to death. And the Soviets count it all up, and they've got, oh, my God, we've got 91,000 prisoners here. These poor guys, a lot of them were walking wounded. You know, most haven't eaten in ages and so on. Physically, they're in a terrible state. And they just got marched out into snow and then had to march all over Soviet Union to various gulags where they just dropped like flies, mainly from typhus, cholera. So by end of Jan, 43, so within 3 to 4 months, the majority were dead. And in the end, when they were finally released in the 50s, about 5,000 got back. And again, you know, Paulus, of course, he'd been taken prisoner. And he went to, you know, a special camp for general officers and was actually quite well looked after. And then at the end of the war, I mean, it was his kind of final betrayal, is that he did a press conference and he was asked by a journalist about the fate of his men who'd gone into captivity with him. And he said, oh, I can assure the wives and mothers that they're all perfectly fine. There's no way that he didn't know that the vast majority were dead. And there were very, very few left. It's the mark of the man. He was a very strange character. He really does stand out among senior German officers. They produced an awful lot of very, very good commanders, and aggression tended to be one of the dominant characteristics of the senior German officer corps. And decisiveness in command, and he just didn't have it at all.
But for a staff officer, he seems to have lacked the idea of to grasp of any of his logistics or his logistical problems that he's facing him, which you have thought, if you're a poor field commander, you would at least have a grasp of the logistics.
You're absolutely right, Angus, and that's what I don't get. I mean, and all of the work I read on him was, yeah, his staff work was second to none. He had issues in lots of his kind of competence reports. He went through the ranks about ability. You know, he had it was said he had a lack of ability to you know, be decisive and make quick decisions. He said, but they always said, and you could see that at Stalingrad. But you know, in terms of his staff work, they said it's second to none. Why doesn't he bring that to bear in any part of the campaign? Because from the very start, when he was given his task, didn't take a junior staff officer to go, I'm not equipped for that. You know, just looking at the distance and what had happened, you know, in the previous year, because it's not like all of a sudden, oh, don't worry, there'll be loads and loads of tarmac metal roads now and the conditions will be fantastic and we can live off the land and et cetera, and there'll be loads of fuel and et cetera. He knew that, and yet he you know, it was a stumble. He was always kind of having to react to things that were going on, and then just didn't seem to grasp or do the hard work that was necessary to even make those decisions. I mean, there's always been a big thing about it since the war that his chief of staff, Arthur Schmidt, by the end was pretty much making any and all decisions. Paulus would just be in the background. And he was suffering from dysentery. He earlier had a facial tic, which when under stress became quite pronounced. And that really was happening. He lost a lot of weight, mainly because of his dysentery as well. So he was physically in a bit of a way. But even so, he just abrogated responsibility at almost every point during the campaign. I mean, so he was, for me, that was also the kind of key point, was learning that the relationship that Paulus had with Hitler, that really was, I think, the kind of the turning point. Because before that, Hitler, of course, had sacked quite a few generals, you know. But he'd done that, and then when he realised that the German army hadn't risen up and pushed him out of power, that, oh, I can actually do that. Because he'd always been worried. That was his always, you know, he always knew the only force strong enough to oust him and his gang out of power was the German army. And so he always was wary of it. And then after Barbarossa's failure, where he sacked a whole coterie of senior officers, and they didn't rebel against him, that was a big green light for Hitler. But it was his relationship with Paulus that for me was the big turning point, because all of a sudden then he had a personal relationship with a guy he then promoted to field marshal level, where that guy would only act on Hitler's say-so. So before, senior commanders had taken a lot of what Hitler said under advisement. Famously, you know, Reichenau, when he took over, he withdrew from Rostov-on-Don. So when Hitler had specifically said, "Don't, you can't do that," and Reichenau said, "Well, I kind of can because I'm a good commander," and of course Hitler didn't sack him. It was the right decision and so on. But with Paulus, all of a sudden, Hitler, you know, for him, it was going back to what we said about, you know, inferiority complex he had about his generals. All of a sudden, he's got this incredibly intelligent, educated, the epitome of the guy that he's kind of always had a chip on his shoulder about. And for Hitler, it's an immense sense of power and a freeing of the shackles. And from then onwards, really, the process of Hitler micromanaging the war really does start to accelerate. You know, there have been signs of it earlier, without a doubt. But from then onwards, it was, you know, I'm the man. You know, these guys are minions. You know, before I was scared about them. Now they'll just do as they're told.
I've never thought of Stalingrad as rather being the loss of men. It's actually the change in Hitler's attitude to the war being actually probably a bigger turning point that drives him into the ground after that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is. It's you know, all of a sudden after that, you've got, you know, there's this meant to be amazing machine of the German General Staff that he's just subordinated to one man's will and any crazy decision that he happens to make.
If you don't like it, you're fired, put someone else in. If you don't like it, you're fired, put someone else in.
Exactly. And they don't act together. And that's the thing, you know, it's you know, their only hope was the German generals at that level was then they all kind of band together and say, "Oh, we're not going to have this." And they just don't. They just cannot work together. And I think that was Hitler's kind of realization when he realized that Paulus and Manstein weren't coming together with Weichs and Rundstedt and to turn around and form a united front to say, "No, this is what we're going to do," you know, and because it's the right decision militarily, and we're the guys that know. And you can pick Paulus off. He'd always done it politically before they seized power, divide and rule. And he did it within his own party. And he realised it worked. It worked with the military as well. It worked with the generals, just as it had done, you know, with his own team.
Well, that's a great point. And another reason the Battle of Stalingrad could be seen as a turning point, not just militarily. Thanks, John. We will leave it there. Loyal listener, if you want to read John's book, I will put a link on the website. It is titled The Battle of Stalingrad Through German Eyes, The Death of the Sixth Army. If you have enjoyed this episode of the podcast, don't forget you can become a patron of the show by paying a dollar or so each month. You help me fund the show and find the time to put it all together. I do try to make extras available for patrons when I have them. So for the last episode, I made available nearly 20 minutes of Anthony Tucker-Jones and I chatting about the strategic bomber campaign against Germany, amongst other things. So if you'd like to join the gang, go to patreon.com/WW2podcast. It's a big thank you to all those who support the show already. So that's patreon.com/WW2podcast. I'm not sure what we'll be talking about in the next episode. I think I might have a bonus episode to slip in before the next regular episode, but we'll see. Until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
Jerry, 88mm gun hit our town, blew us the hell out of it.
Stalingrad can never be repaired.
As Allied Commander-in-Chief, I have granted a military armistice.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.